This is Channel 253. Channel 253 is sponsored by Alaska Airlines. I'm Nate Bowling and I fly Alaska. To book your next trip, go to alaskaair.com. This is the Nerd Farmer Podcast, a national conversation through a local lens. Greetings, greetings. This is Nate Bowling, host of the Nerd Farmer Podcast, coming to you from the soundproof and delightful Moon Yard Studios here in gorgeous North Tacoma. Farm fam, if you've listened to the show for a while, you understand that this is not an education podcast. I actually am yet to find, well, there's one out there, Visions of Ed, but I'm yet to find like an Ed podcast that I really enjoy. This podcast is Ed-adjace, because too often Ed podcasts want to talk about only about education, but things that happen in classrooms don't happen in silos. And so like, you all know that like I go out and I speak about education stuff all the time, but like if you aren't talking about housing and education, then you ain't saying nothing. If you aren't talking about race and education, you ain't saying nothing. If you aren't talking about health and education, you ain't saying nothing. And so I also think that one of the things we need to talk about is like teachers. If you aren't talking about teachers and ed, you ain't saying nothing. And so there's a reporter who I respect deeply, who I have in the studio today, and she's done a lot of reporting on teacher diversity, and we're going to roll around in that and a lot of life issues as well. And so I'd like to welcome back to the studio for the second time, Dolly Bazaz. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here again.
So your title has changed since last time you were in studio. Last time you were the engagement editor for Education Lab at Seattle Times.
Yes.
And now you are the Seattle Times or a Seattle Times education reporter.
Yes.
Okay. Let's just dive into this. Can you talk about the reporting? And by the way, the deep, like voluminous reporting you've done on teacher diversity in Washington State, because it's a story that like needs to be told.
Sure. So about, 8 months ago, I partnered with another reporter down in Southwest Washington at a newspaper called The Columbian. Her name is Katie Gillespie. And we put together a series on the demographics of teachers in Washington State, and we compared them to student demographics.
And they only one-to-one, right? It's perfect, yes?
Oh, yeah. That's really close. Not even close. So just as background, about 88% of Washington teachers are white. Bulk of those people are white women. And about 45% of students in Washington are people of color. And that keeps growing as our younger population in the state continues to diversify. And that's pretty much true around the country. Our student population is getting more diverse. And Washington State isn't producing enough teachers of color to keep up with that. We looked at data sets from the State Education Department going back 6 years. We put together a map that calculates a ratio for each race. So in the map, you can look at how many Latinx students there are per Latinx teacher. And it's sort of a heat map, so you can filter through it and see where districts are more or less representative. And so what we found through some of our data reporting there is that it would take more than a century to keep to make the two populations proportionate. And that has a lot of implications for students themselves. As I reported on recently, there was a story that I wrote yesterday. Seems like it's been a century since then. teachers of color and students of color have different relationships when it comes to discipline. And so there are instances where maybe a white teacher may react to a black student's actions in class in a different way. And some people are calling an incident that happened recently in Seattle public schools as an example of that. There was an incident back in May where a teacher called the police because a black fifth grader allegedly threatened to beat her up, and puffed his chest out.
Wait, I got to lean in for a second.
Yeah.
You mean to tell me that a grown-ass adult called the police because they were scared of a fifth grader?
That's not what was in the police report.
Okay.
But you could imply whatever you want from that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
she felt unsafe around the student. That's what she told the police. She filed a non-emergency police report, I guess. She called 911, I think, and then she said she would like to file a non-emergency report. The principal discussed with her other options besides calling the police, but she decided to do so anyway. That action is protected by her teacher's contract. And she told the police that you can't use expletives on this podcast.
Do you boo?
So he allegedly told her, I'm going to beat the fucking shit out of you, and I don't care that you're a woman, when she wouldn't let him leave class. He's about 10 or 11 years old. She's not sure. No weapons. He didn't raise his fists or anything. He puffed his chest out. And he was taken to the office or wherever he was supervised. And about 2 hours after that incident, she called the police. And so now a lot of people are talking about what would have been the reaction if this had been a white student.
Sure.
And there are studies that show that black kids are, even at a young age, believed to be more threatening or less innocent than their other peers. And so that's some of the wider context. There are also things like academic outcomes, investment in students that can differ by race. So if you have a teacher that shares your race, you're more likely to go on to high school or graduate high school or go on to college. There have been big studies about that in other states. Unfortunately, there hasn't been anything outcome-based tied to teacher and student racial match because there isn't a large enough sample here to do that. There are researchers here that haven't been able to do that.
I remember clicking around through the data in your reporting that came along, and one of the numbers that I saw where I was just like, are you kidding me, is that there's fewer than 1,000 black teachers in Washington State.
Yeah.
And like it's not like it's like 999, like it's in like the low eights. And so in a state with like a population of 8 million people, to have fewer than 1,000 black teachers is really crazy. But it also gives like light to some of the things that I see happening in the classroom and in schools. And so like I hear you telling the story. At my school that I work at, it's interesting. At my school where I've taught for the last 10 years and don't work anymore, moment for myself there, 80% of student population is brown. But it's a mix, right? So I call the school sometimes like Benetton High because it's 20% black, 20% white, 20% Asian, mainly Vietnamese Cambodian, 20% Hispanic Latino, and the last 20% is a mix and a smattering of Native Americans, Pacific Islander, kids from Southwest Asia, and then mixed race. So the school is just hella beige, right? But the staff isn't, right? But the staff is actually more brown than staffs at surrounding high schools, which is like we're really like mainly due to the principal's work that like Pat hires well. I say all that because I wonder, are there places in the state that are doing this well with representation? Because like to me, somebody listening to this show should know that like representation matters, and I shouldn't have to pitch that. If you've been listening, this is episode like 74 or something like that. Like if you've been along this ride, you should know that. Is anybody doing this well?
There are districts that have shown some progress in recruitment of teachers of color and have changed the way that they hire and filter candidates in order to diversify the pool of teachers that they have. But I can't really give you any district that has anywhere close to representative unless you're talking about a majority white district and its teaching force. So yeah, I mean, there are a ton of if you look at the map and you filter by white as the race, there are a lot of districts that are overrepresentative of white students, but not for any racial category other than that.
Let's go there, actually.
So I
assume that somebody listening to this show understands why this matters, but I'm going to ask you to make the case for that person anyway, maybe they're a new listener. Why does teacher diversity matter? Like you talk about the discipline issues, and I have my own thoughts, but like from your point of view, why does this matter?
So one thing that I was thinking about the entire time that I was working on the series is the idea that teachers and teaching is the profession that young people get arguably the most exposure to. Mm-hmm. starting out in life, and they're also sort of a figure of authority. So when you look at the front of the classroom and you see someone or you see the same type of person every single day, you're going to think that the people that hold the knowledge, who are able to shape you and guide you, are going to be most of the time white women. Mm-hmm. And that has implications down the road. I think there's a psychological impact to that as well. I mean, we talk about this with mass media, with who we pick to be in TV shows, with movies, but kids are also going to school every day, presumably. And that can have a whole lot of different consequences. Just thinking about role models and if you don't have someone who's who has shown that you can be in a teaching position, because it's like a self-perpetuating cycle as well. If you don't see someone who looks like you at the front of the classroom, why would you want to be a teacher as well? So I think it's an issue of varying the authority figures in a class.
I've also said to audiences, like in talks that I've given, that white students benefit from this as well.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to have the view that black people are inferior or that South Asians are dumb and only work in convenience stores if the person standing in front of you delivering instruction to you, teaching you calculus, teaching government, is a person of color. Like, black people are inferior, but my calculus teacher is a black man. South Asians are inferior, but my government teacher is from Bangladesh. Like, it can help interrupt racism in white students as well. You talked about like the school discipline thing. One of the things, and this is something that I've observed. I'm just curious in your thoughts. Mm-hmm. One of the manifestations of racism that I see the most is, frankly, a hate of black joy. Like, so many racist incidents that we see, like when folks are calling the police, are actually responses to just black people enjoying themselves. And people view black joy as a form of manifestation of aggression. Thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm sure that happens in school environments as well. I'm not sure if this is what happened in the incident that I've recently covered, but I mean,
well, yeah, that's not joy. I'm a F you up. I don't care if you're a woman. That's not joy, to be clear. Yeah, but
yeah. I mean, we have examples of that all the time. I mean, I'm thinking of that woman that called the police when she saw a group of black people in the park.
Yep.
I mean, it's like, how dare you be so audacious as to enjoy yourselves in a public space and play music and talk amongst your friends and family. I mean, and you were talking about sort of like the intersection of issues with education, mm-hmm. and why you like to listen to podcasts that don't focus solely on education. That's definitely an intersecting issue. People interpret other people's, people of other races' joy in, I guess, menacing ways. And I'm sure this happens in the school environment. We look at the way that students of color dress and the way they're penalized for that, the way they wear their hair. That there are so many examples of that in the school system. And if you were just doing straight education, like school board reporting, you wouldn't catch any of that stuff.
Like, I can't tell you the number of times I've talked to a student and, like, they were being disruptive, but, like, what they were actually doing was, like, engaging on their terms.
Mm.
And, like, them being excited and wanting to be in the conversation, like, the teacher wasn't capable of managing the classroom in a way that created a space for that student to engage in the conversation. So they saw, like, student excitement about learning as being, like, disruptive behavior, and I'm just like, you gotta harness that. Like, you got my own personal, like,
yeah.
If I was gonna like go the I'm gonna do PD for teachers route, it would be like harnessing like student joy, because so much teaching crushes joy because like we want kids to conform to this model in a classroom. Now I'm depressing myself. I'll shut up. So we have this issue about teacher diversity. You research and report that it's lacking. And so then every school district is responding to you and banging down your door saying, help us fix this, right?
No.
Okay. So then they were saying, we're going to fix this, right?
Yes.
Okay. So like, what are some of the plans that are happening out in Washington State to address this?
So there are a few grants through the Professional Educators Standards Board.
Oh, you actually say it out. In the business, we call it the PESB Board. It's just PESB.
PESB, okay.
Yeah.
I was just trying to be nice to your listeners in case they don't know the name of all the education boards in the state. And so they have some grant programs that help with things like grow your own programs that take paraeducators or teacher's aides or whatever the preferred terminology is. And they give them scholarships and sort of a straight route to a teacher. teaching position in a school. So they help them through college, get their bachelor's degree. And one of the reasons that's helpful is because our paraeducator workforce is actually a lot more diverse than our teacher workforce. And that's related to issues of higher education access. Sure. And so there are lots of paraeducators who speak Spanish, who, you know, live in the Yakima region, who are benefiting from these Grow Your Own programs and throughout the rest of the state as well. And they're working in classrooms. They enjoy teaching students. They're doing the work of teachers. Yeah. And they don't have the certification. And so these programs are trying to harness something that's already existing in the schools. And my colleague, Neil Morton, I'm just going to put a plug. He did a series on paraeducators recently, and you can find that on the Seattle Times website.
Former show guest, by the way, and we'll link to that in the show notes, too.
Yeah. So to get a little bit into the weeds here, another thing that these large urban school districts are doing, like Highline and Bellevue, not Seattle, because there's a teachers union contract issue there, but they're trying to filter their candidates at the district level so that it's not solely up to individual principals to interview the candidates and decide who's going to be there. And so if the people at the district level or at the central headquarters have discussed, okay, we're going to use the Rooney Rule, or we're going to make sure we have a slate of candidates that meets the demographics of our students, it's a little bit it's less weight on the principal's shoulders. They can often be kind of slammed to like pull that candidate. I mean, it just helps with the filtering. So they'll do the interviews at the district level. They'll bring people from a whole bunch of different schools. They'll bring principals from other schools, and then they'll weed the finalists out from there. Yeah. And then the principals can pick from that pool.
My experience when I was entering the job market back in the day, back in 2006, good Lord, was that essentially like I interviewed with Tacoma HR and an administrator and was given a letter of intent to hire and then interviewed with schools. And that process made sense to me because like I was guaranteed a job but not a placement. Mm. But in Seattle, you were saying they have that decentralized system where like every hire is site-based. And so I understand why a principal wants that and why site-based hiring makes a lot of sense, but also site-based hiring can be very inequitable as well. So that's fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, there are definitely exceptions to that. I mean, every year Seattle Public Schools shifts around its teachers for mm-hmm. budget cuts and stuff, and then teachers go to places that they like. They just swapped around. They don't really have a choice in that. But
I wonder so charters are new to Washington State, like they opened in like 2012, whatever. Mm-hmm. Data for them is less available for obvious reasons. Either data-wise or anecdotally, are they doing a better or worse job on this diversity thing, or do you just not know at all?
I'm not really sure. I remember eyeballing a few of them in my data set. It's hard to tell because they are pretty new in the state. And this is maybe something that I could do for a follow-up look to see if they're doing anything differently. As far as I remember, I think their teaching staffs might be more diverse than the statewide average, slightly. I'm not sure why that is. I couldn't tell you.
Sure. Yeah. So I joked about the policymaker response. What's been the public response to your reporting?
I think the latter parts of the series where I looked at more of the impact of teachers of color on students was sort of the emotional trigger for a lot of people. That's a lot of people got back to me because it spoke to sort of the extra energy that teachers of color put in every day on their jobs because they're often the only person of color in their building or the only Black teacher in their building. And so they take on other mentorship and they feel like all of the requests to mitigate discipline, to improve someone's academic performance are filtered through them, and that's a huge weight to carry. Yeah. And so I got responses from teachers of color about that. And we did a call out where we asked people to send in their responses to the series and talk about a teacher of color that impacted their school days. And so I mean, I think it's that piece of seeing someone who looks like you or someone who's maybe doesn't even look like you, but offered you a different perspective on whatever you were learning. That's emotional for people. And we spend a lot of time with our teachers and they shape who we are inevitably.
Former Secretary of Education John Brown calls it the double taxation. And so, like, if you're the only black teacher in an urban school, you're going to get sent more black students and you're going to get sent kids who are troubled. And not those Venn diagrams overlap, so I'm not saying they do, but because you're good with those kids. And what happens is that if you have a well-earning classroom, they talk about your classroom discipline, not your practice as a teacher, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, until awards started showing up at my house, like, I was known as being a good classroom manager but not a good instructor. And so I think about that a lot. I think about how I have an entire 10-year generation of kids who basically call me, like young black males call me Unc, right? I got a water polo shirt, Uncle Bowling on the back. And like, that's the role that I serve for those students. And like, it's necessary and I love that job. That's part of the work. Mm-hmm. But that work would be easier if there was more than one of us in the building.
Yeah.
And one thing I'm proud of is that like the second black teacher to join my staff as an instructor, who like wasn't a coach, wasn't a counselor, was a former student who I gave the toast at his wedding. And so like I'm leaving Lincoln at this point.
That's
but like
so sweet.
I'm leaving Lincoln at this point, but like but Corey's there and Corey's job is to grow more as well. I want to ask this, and you hinted there aren't that many, but I am curious. Are there any states out there that are doing a better job with this and have more diverse teaching forces? And if so, like how did they get there?
So from my very small analysis of other states, because Washington really falls in the middle of the line, I thought it might come out worse. but it actually is pretty much in the middle. Surprisingly, and maybe not surprisingly, but Texas actually has a lot more routes to teacher certification, which people mm-hmm. can argue about. Some people think that impacts the quality of the candidates. But Texas, and I think because of its demographics, it's a lot more demographically diverse than Washington State.
I want to honor Doug's confused face. Can you talk about the controversy over like alt routes in the profession? Because I think about this, like I want traditional certification, like I have an undergrad degree in economics and then a graduate degree in teaching. But like for career changers, can you kind of walk through those a little bit if you don't mind?
I don't know if I'm the best person to do this, but I'll give it a try.
I'll take it.
So there are routes to getting your teacher certification that you know you hinted at that don't necessarily involve you having to go through college and get a bachelor's degree. And some states have different standards about what you need in order to get certified by the state. And I think Texas has a little bit more leniency about what you need. I'm not sure about their actual requirements, but there are programs like Teach for America that are pretty controversial.
Yeah.
And I, you know, because of the temporary nature of that program and a whole bunch of other things, but you know, there's definitely a debate that maybe this is sort of an elitism, the pushback to like alternative routes to being a teacher.
Can we have this conversation really fast? Because I find myself of two minds of this.
Mm-hmm.
Like I am somebody that says that becoming a teacher should be harder than it is, and that teachers should be higher regarded and paid more, and that remaining a teacher should be harder and evaluations should be more. So when I say evaluation should be more rigorous, what oftentimes that means is more BS, but evaluation's more rigorous of the work that's happening. And so like I want to elevate the teaching force. At the same time, I'm anti-gatekeeping. And I hate the idea that like whenever we create accreditations for things, we're basically creating walls that low-income people and people of color struggle to overcome and surmount. So I'm of two minds on this. I know your report is really neutral on stuff, but like what are your thoughts on this idea of like teacher excellence and accreditation versus alt routes? And like because what I hear people say is we want more routes into the profession to diversify the profession. I nod. But I also understand that more routes ends up meaning that potentially we could get less quality in the profession. And so like that makes me nervous because like I don't want jabronis with a fly-by-night certification showing up and like teaching vulnerable kids.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it this is less about alternative routes and it is about like standards, because some of the stuff that I reported on in the series touches on like in Washington, we have something called the West B and the West A and West C, yeah. I think.
I took West B and West E. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's West E.
Basic and endorsement.
Okay. So there are statistics that show that people of color who take the West B, which is the first test you take, fail. At a higher rate than white candidates do. And that mimics what we see with standardized tests to get into college. And there isn't a lot of solid research that shows that your performance on the WSB exam is going to dramatically alter how good of a teacher you are. Because that you take that before you go into teaching college.
And I'm here again, or I'm of two minds about it, right? I'm like, passing the West B doesn't make you better, but like on the flip side, I'm like, that exam is not hard. And so like, I keep going, please.
So one of the things that that PESB got through the legislature this year was they removed the requirement to pass this test in order to enter teaching colleges in Washington State. So you still have to take it. You still have to have a score. But teaching colleges don't have to look at that and say, "Okay, you're not passing this. We're not letting you in." So they can look at where you did well or where you did poorly on the test, and then give you classes to essentially help you in the areas that you didn't do well.
I'm struggling so much of this because, like, just because I'm a good test taker doesn't mean I'm a good teacher, right? But like, damn, these tests ain't that hard either. Like I sat for the West B.
What kind of questions did they ask?
Oh shit, I don't remember. It was like 13 years ago. What I remember is the West B was basically like, it reminded me a lot of like the PSAT. It's like that level test.
Did you do well on the SAT?
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Fine. Valid. Well played.
And then, I did horribly on the SAT.
Here.
And I think I turned out okay.
We're gonna do this very quietly. We're gonna write down scores. No, I'm totally kidding. And I sat for the West E, and the West E was such a hodgepodge of randomness. And so, like, I was adding English endorsement. Well, this nobody cares about any of this. But, like, the West E for social studies was pretty straightforward to me. I remember writing an essay about the New Deal in political cartoon. The West E for writing in English was all over the place. So it was, like, the answers, like, in a row were, like, Beverly Cleary, Chaucer, and all white, by the way. Beverly Cleary, Chaucer, Dr. Seuss. Just, like, just scattershot of literature. Mm-hmm. Like, So here's my thing, and I'm gonna shut up. We'll go to break. I want there to be a high standard, and I want quality. But the mechanisms that we have don't bring a high standard in quality. But like, there also aren't better ideas out there, I feel like, too, and that's where I feel stuck.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons they removed the requirement as well was that it was a cost burden to a lot of people who were maybe taking community college classes at the time, paying out of pocket for that. And they were having to retake these tests multiple times. There is a caveat to that. I mean, they still don't have a great through rate between the people that take the test and pass it and who actually apply to teaching colleges and get accepted.
Sure.
So, but it also hasn't been that long since they removed that requirement, so we'll see what happens. It all happens with a few years of data. We can reevaluate that.
That's fair. And if I haven't said it yet, F all the testing companies. So we'll take a break, and when we come back, I want to get a little bit into the nitty-gritty about what it was like doing this reporting in cooperation with Kate down in Vancouver, and then also you're going to turn the tables on me and interview me for a little bit too.
Okay, so great.
We'll be back.
This is Eric Hanberg, host of the Channel 253 sister podcast, We Art Tacoma. Channel 253 is sponsored by our friends at Tacoma Arts Live. Tacoma Arts Live energizes our community through live performance. Their mission is right there in the name. There's nothing like sitting in a crowded theater, elbow to elbow, as the lights go down and you feel that sense of anticipation of what's to come. Depending on the night, the experience at Tacoma Arts Live might engage us intellectually, touch us emotionally, or keep us laughing all night long. But no matter our reaction, at the core of that experience, we are flexing our most valuable muscle, our empathy, a crucial building block to the civic life of our community. Last year, more than 250,000 people attended an event in the Tacoma Arts Live venues. That's a lot of people. It's a sign of how vital Tacoma Arts Live is and how their diversity of programs mirror our community and how much we value that kind of experience. Connect with your community by visiting TacomaArtsLive.org to find an upcoming show that is right for you. Energize your passion and play your part. My thanks to Tacoma Arts Live for their support of Channel 253.
And we are back. Farm Fam, I want to thank you for tuning into the show. I'm going to ask you to do two favors to make the show happen. I'm going to ask you, one, to go to iTunes or whatever you use to listen to the show and write us a review. Your reviews make it easier for people to find the show. And number two, if you haven't done so, please, please, please think about buying a subscription and joining us in Channel 253. They are $4 a month and $40 a year, and those help pay for the cost of production and help us put on cool events. The third thing I'm going to ask for you, since she's in the house, is you support local journalism, and the Seattle Times mm-hmm. is the paper record in the region. They've offered me the platform in the Sunday paper several times to talk about things that matter to me. And if Washington state politics are going to have vigilance, it's going to come from the Seattle Times. There. I like that expression. Thank you. So, Dahlia, I want to ask you about the, like, mechanics of this. Mm. So what was it? Backing up a step. So you basically co-did this work with somebody at another paper.
Yes, I did.
What was it like working with Katie, and how did that partnership come about?
So Katie and I both attended this seminar on data journalism for the Education Writers Association. And so it's a...
Oh, EWA, yeah.
You know EWA?
That's yes.
Great. Okay. Of course you do. so it was like a data crunching workshop, and I learned how to do something called standard query language, or SQL, which is like Excel on steroids. And I was talking with Katie because we both realized we were from Washington State, and, you know, we were chit-chatting, like, what data set did you bring to this workshop? And we both realized at the same time that we had teacher diversity data. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, so this person is in a different region of the state. Yep. I'm probably not going to get to, like, drive down to Southwest Washington and do a whole tour of the state. Why not partner with her to make this story happen? Because there are things that happen outside of the Puget Sound region, go figure, that might be helpful for the rest of the state to know. And I think in this era of dwindling newsrooms newspaper budget deficits, partnering with other organizations is always a good idea, because you don't have the staff or the bandwidth to cover every region. So from there, we started requesting more data, and it actually, you know, it took us more than a year to work on this story because we were so far away and we were both, like, working beat jobs. It was my first year on the education beat.
Sure.
And we had all those teacher strikes, and so that got interrupted. It got interrupted by a lot of different events on our beat, and we would sort of come back to this data set and think about what we could glean from it over and over again. And so we really buckled down about 4 or 5 months before the series came out, which was in December 2018. And we downloaded all of the student demographic data sets, and we played a little bit with looking at the outcome data to see if we could determine whether or not school districts that have more teachers of color, if their disciplinary racial breakdown was a little bit more balanced or in line, and we looked at test scores as well. It just didn't work. Mm-hmm. So we just decided to focus on the demographics and pull in data from outside research that had a larger sample pool.
How has this reporting resonated with the public? So I saw public responses. Have you seen, like, action take forth from this? Are there folks who have seen this as a call to arms?
So I've seen it in the footnotes of a few, like, local bills. So Seattle's education levy cited the story. And so it's been because it's such a data heavy story, and we talk a lot about ratios, and, like, we set, like, the base level information of what the numbers are for each racial category. It's been a good, like, jumping off point for policymakers to refer to. So I've seen it in presentations. They take our little charts with or without attribution and talk about them. And so that's been like the data portion of it. That's been sort of the reaction. We're also out in schools and talking to teachers about this issue and talking to students about this issue. And I think I hinted at this a little bit previous to the show, but it was a lot of like nesting inside of district offices and talking to their HR teams and trying to understand what their actual rationale was. Take me inside the hiring process. What are you doing to diversify your candidate pool? And I will say that like Bellevue and Highline were really transparent. I didn't get the chance to embed in the same way that I did with Seattle because they also didn't have the sort of the record that Bellevue and Highline had in hiring more teachers of color proportionate to their size. And I had to do Seattle because we're the Seattle Times. But I went to their recruiting events. I went to different classrooms. I talked to their recruiters. Highline, I'm not sure what it looks like now, but Highline had an almost entirely people of color recruiting team. Mm-hmm. They would go out to community events and talk to people, and not even for certified teachers, but like they would recruit paraeducators. If they notice someone speaking Spanish, they walk over to them. People on the recruiting team speak Spanish, and they'd get into a conversation, and they make the pitch. They walk around with cards. And so the reaction to that, I've heard some like college professors say that like they want to talk about this in their classrooms, like education professors. Again, there was also sort of the like emotional response from teachers, a lot of whom are like, I can't seem to get hired somewhere. Like, what's going on? Yeah. And I didn't really have an answer to that. There were so many threads we could have tugged at in this series, and there are so many questions left unanswered that we weren't able to tackle, even in three stories. There was an anti-affirmative action law that Washington had, which they just struck down. But I was really curious to see if that impacted the way that school districts were hiring. We couldn't determine that. There's also like the other pool of educators, like paraeducators, that are in the classroom, and we didn't study those because it would have been a much larger undertaking. So we decided to only look at certified teachers. So it doesn't tell every single story, unfortunately. Sure. And I also wish that I could have looked at how does gender also impact student outcomes. And in any case, I still hear from people who like the series. And I hope that beyond what I've been able to catch, when you're a reporter, it's hard to gauge exactly. Like if you don't have like a law passing, like you can't really draw a straight line sometimes between the reporting you do and what happens, because like part of that is like, I mean, there are reporters that like have the ego to just be like, after my series ran, like they definitely read my series and did this thing. Yeah. There have been like little ripples or like changes in the way that Seattle Public Schools talks about the recruiting that I've been like, maybe that's related. But I can't say for sure.
So one of the issues that I see in Washington State is that ed power is really diffused. So we talk about the PESB board, also the state board, right? Mm-hmm. There's all these boards, and then OSPI has some power, and there's ESDs. And so I guess I want to ask you kind of as an exit question here. If I made you the Washington State czar of teacher diversity, what would your policy recommendations be statewide?
I can't do that. I can't do – I'm not I might be getting into tough territory here as a reporter.
Can I say that the folks who are doing it can't do it either, apparently? So you just take a swing. Just take a swing. Fine. So it's not Washington State. It's a fictitious state. This is a hypothetical state. So it's not Washington State anymore. Hypothetically, if you wanted to create a more diverse teacher force, what do you think should be done?
So one thing that we got into a little bit in the story, and I'm just basing this off of facts. I mean, there's the barrier to higher education that has to be addressed because it's all interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So I think expansion of like aid and scholarships are all good things. I think there's also sort of a I don't want to say ideological, but like a stigma battle to be won. There are a lot of students of color that take a look at that field, or they know their teachers of color are swamped, and they're like, I don't want anything to do with this. Yeah. And this isn't a policy that I can really create, but like this is something that recruiters and principals who are looking for teachers of color, there's a principal out in Philly that goes to different high schools and asks students, majority black schools, like he's like, so who's ever thought about being a teacher? And they laugh. They laugh like it's a joke.
Yeah. He's at Mastery Charter. He's dope, though.
Yeah. And, you know, so that's I don't know how you can create a policy around that. I'm not a policymaker. Mm. My job is to write things that could potentially become policy.
That's fair. And shout out to Sharif. Like, you do really good work out there in Philadelphia.
Yes, absolutely.
We end the show with a thing called the wind down. And so I want to ask you, for listeners, what's one thing they should watch, one they should read, and one thing they should listen to? And the read can't be your paper for obvious reasons, because like they're already reading that, hopefully.
Okay. The one thing they should watch is a TV show called Rami.
Mm-hmm.
It is on Hulu. It's an incredible show, and it's about a Egyptian-American man who's growing up with this existential crisis. Or actually, he's not growing up. He's like, I think he's pushing 30 in this show, or 28 or something. And he is dealing with this sort of friction in his identity, like being raised Muslim and not drinking, but also like interacting with like dating and sex and relationships. And it represented a part of my childhood and like the weird decisions that I had to make to like pay tribute to where I came from and where my parents came from, and also navigate this world as a child of immigrants.
Wait, it occurs to me, by the way, that, so if people heard the first time, they know where your family is from, but where's your family from?
So my family is from Iraq, but we are ethnically Iranian. So I grew up speaking Arabic, and I don't know any Farsi, but most of my family lives in Iran. It's really confusing.
Sure.
It's because of war and other reasons, a lot of my family doesn't live in Iraq anymore. They live in Iran.
Okay.
And so that's the sort of the framework that I grew up in, grew up here like during the Iraq War. That experience, or the interaction with other people about terrorism, about what's in the news, about the Middle East, that's not a representation that I had really seen very very widely. And so this is like the big first like popular show to speak to the Arab American experience, and not in a way that is like tokenizing or too like on the nose. It does a really good job of keeping its cool. What was the other question?
Listen to and to read.
Okay. Okay, so I've been listening to a lot of Salt and Pepper.
Any album in particular?
No, just Salt and Pepper.
All right. And then one thing to read?
Or Sade.
Okay.
I love Sade. To read, this is a little bit harder. You know what? This might get me in trouble, but my colleague at she's not my like direct colleague, but she's on the education beat with me. Her name is Liz Brazil, and she's the education reporter at Crosscut.
Yep.
And she's doing amazing work, and we've become very good friends sitting next to each other at school board meetings. And she's been doing like really good, thorough reporting. And I would encourage you to read her stories, and to support local education journalism.
They're on a hiring spree over there. They hired over Santos and Mo. I'm impressed.
Yeah, they stole Mo from us.
Okay, so last question, we call the Katie Downs question. It's named after a local establishment. What's one thing that everybody loves that you know is actually trash?
Milk. It's disgusting. Most of us can't digest it. It's been used by white supremacists as propaganda. Have you seen those videos where they just chug a glass of milk? Like, you don't want to be around milk.
From milk comes cheese.
There is... Big dairy is a thing.
I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
That's the best answer ever. If people want to follow you on the socials, where should they look?
Just go on Twitter, Dahlia Bazzaz. My name is kind of hard to spell, DahliaBazzaz. And that's the only thing I really post on regularly. So
thank you for coming down. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Wakanda forever, y'all. Thank you. Milk. Channel 253 is sponsored by Alaska Airlines. I'm Nate Bowling, and I fly Alaska. To book your next trip, go to alaskaair.com.
You said don't say it like pizzazz, but it's like...
No, I'm saying don't say on the microphone like pizzazz.
Okay, got it.
But it's like...
Okay, yeah. This is reverse psychology. Okay. Understood.
The Nerd Farmer podcast is part of the Channel 253 Podcast Network. Check out our other shows. Move to Tacoma, the OG original with the pod auntie. The Interchangeable White Ladies, Citizen Tacoma, Crossing Division, Flounders B-Team, a local soccer show, and Taco Man.
This is Channel 253.